today on Ag News Daily.
The drone itself has two cameras on it. It has a true color camera, and it also has a multispectral near-infrared camera on it.
Happy Friday, Ag News Daily listeners. I've got guest co-host Elaine Cubb joining me. Of course, this is Delaney Howell, one of the hosts for the Ag News Daily podcast. Elaine, how's it going?
Well, we made it through February, so that's this true. Is March. And what do they say? In like a lamb, out like a lion, or the other way around? I don't know how we would define today up in South Dakota. It's cold and it's still snowing, so that means there will be more shoveling in my immediate future. So I don't know how I feel about that.
Do you think it's going to be a delayed planting season this year?
Yeah, actually, I just had this very conversation with the Commodity Week yesterday that, you know, it feels too early to be hitting the panic button about that, but mm-hmm. it's March 1st, but you look at the long-term forecast and this cold weather continues. So you start getting towards, the middle of March. If you don't have, a nice, slow, steady melting of all of this, I think it will start to be a legitimate market issue we would start to worry about. Not getting as many corn acres in or not getting them in a nice early spring. So,
I think kind of two things come to mind when you're talking about all that. The first is that so many guys and gals didn't get into the fields in fall because of weather to get kind of field prep done for planting. So I think that's one thing that could impact planting this year. But then the corn and soybeans acreage discussion. Elaine, in your opinion, you talk to a lot of producers, obviously. You understand the markets maybe a little better than I do, but will the dynamic change? We've got, of course, the USDA estimates, but will the dynamic change on acreage if we don't get into the fields as early as farmers would like? Do you see them switching back to soybeans for a cash flow purpose?
Absolutely. So this is what I'm saying. It's too early to be making that prediction, but it's sort of an if-then statement. Like mm-hmm. if we have a late spring and the snow that is very widespread across the upper Corn Belt, if that doesn't go away, then because spring wheat won't be an option up in the Dakotas and Minnesota, because if it's late, then spring wheat's not an option. So, it goes into soybeans. I don't know. How did people feel about this at a Commodity Classic? Was this a topic, or what did you guys chit-chat about?
Yeah, so to be honest, I was only down there for like 24 hours, so I really didn't get the chance to talk to a lot of growers. I mean, I've talked to a lot of growers just at speeches and commodity meetings here over the last couple of months, and that's been a concern time and time again, is the factor of delayed planting. I think guys are already really aware of that condition or that potential problem.
Yeah, and you are so right to bring up the delays or the inability to get into the field in fall. I kind of forgot about that. Kind of put that into the memory hole. It'll never happen, but you're right. Like, we're already at a backlog of tasks.
Well, I mean, when you look at everything impacting producers right now, that maybe is not one that we've been talking about, because we've been focusing on trade and Washington, D.C. and whatnot, so
more immediate concerns, and this is still a maybe. This is still just frantically checking the 10-day forecast every hour.
Yeah, absolutely. But as I mentioned, there's a lot impacting the world of agriculture right now. This isn't really necessarily directly impacting agriculture, but it could, I suppose, in the future. Elaine, I'm interested to hear your take on it. And that's the meeting between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. They didn't reach an agreement after their 2 days of meetings on Thursday, but apparently had constructive discussions. Madison and I were talking about this on the podcast the other day. Do you see China feeling threatened if the U.S. and North Korea have some sort of trade deal in place, because China trades with North Korea?
Yeah, I suspect that China, I'm not a great expert in geopolitical stuff, and you definitely got your finger on the pulse here, but my impression is that China kind of feels, blocked in from all corners here. There's so much pressure being put on them on a lot of different fronts. Mm-hmm. So it's the IP protection, it's the trade account surplus that they run. It's the, them being the heavy or being influential in this North Korea nuclear scenario. There's so much that's being asked of them, and it's being asked not just by the United States, but I don't get the sense that they look around to the international community and are seeing anybody saying, oh, yeah, China, it's okay for you to
do
the IP stuff. Like, they are definitely feeling the pressure from a lot of fronts.
And now they're feeling the pressure from the WTO because we had the announcement yesterday that essentially they're placing too much money or giving too much money away in subsidy money for some of their producers. And I saw this come out just yesterday, or I guess today, yesterday, this week really, talking about African swine fever. They're continuing to feel the effects of that. They've seen 100 farms reported. Of course, we don't know how accurate that is since they are state-censored media, but the latest kind of expectations are seeing China's hog population could decline anywhere from 15% to 30%. And going along with that, a lot of investors in the pork industry are investing shares and stocks into some of these hog producing companies, pork processors and whatnot. I think because that to me is a clear indication that they see this as a long-term effect. They see that hog prices are going to go on the rise in China and they're trying to buy in now before that happens.
Yeah, isn't that wild?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they, you know, we've seen them admit to culling 1 million head in a month,
mm-hmm.
and they've got what 700 million head. But now you talk about 50% or 30%, or what if that's a low number?
Right.
I mean, who knows? But I will say this: we do see some confirmation of that in this week's export sales report, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I remember that there was a significant burst of Chinese buying U.S. pork. So that should continue. I mean, I think we're starting to see actual evidence of that business starting to come in. So the investors that are looking 5 months, 6 months down the road and expecting to see perhaps a rally in the hog market this summer, that's a reality that I could buy into that.
Well, that's the thing, too, is like we bought into that African swine fever story so early on. And then it's like now you look at the markets and they're hitting new lows. They're not really finding a bottom yet. You think it's going to take until summer before we actually see them to pick up?
Yeah, so if you look at a continuous chart, you're right. It's not real exciting, but you look at the structure of the futures contracts month after month after month. It's those summer contracts, the July contract, August kind of time frame, that those contracts start getting hotter and hotter. The spread from 1 month to the next is pricing that in. But you're right that we've been pricing it in for 6 months already.
Mm-hmm.
We keep on saying it's 6 months down the line, and now 6 months down the line, we're saying, oh, it's another 6 months down the line. It's really impossible to predict because, like you say, we don't – I don't know. I mean, even if we 100% trusted whatever numbers the Chinese mm-hmm. government was coming up with, even if they were being completely transparent about it, it's not something that you can predict, I suspect. I mean, modeling the mathematical way that this, pathogen moves through a population that has some smuggling going on, some cross-border, some rural transportation of
right.
these animals, that's just impossible to predict.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. It makes me wonder if longer term this type of African swine fever disease has the ability to change the Chinese protein diet.
Yeah, wouldn't that be something?
Yeah.
Man, can you imagine, like, what is the global protein diet going to be 20 years from now if Americans are all eating fake?
Ew, I don't even want it. No.
I know, like, don't even get started. But what if that happens and then China is eating, I don't know, what, more beef?
Yeah, let's hope beef.
But, you know, gosh, I suspect it will be vastly different, maybe even 5 years from now than what we have today.
Yeah, I think so, too. And another thing that could change, switching from protein to crops, that's the production of acreage in the United States. We saw hemp get legalized in 2020. We're seeing CBD oil and hemp-related products hit the market really hard right now, but earlier this week during his testimony, Secretary Perdue told the Senate Ag Committee that the USDA is going to proceed very slowly and judiciously on implementing hemp provisions, and it won't be ready until 2020 to really regulate that. But I've just been fascinated by this, and I've talked to a lot of producer groups about this and a lot of trade folks about this or analysts about this of – do you see some of those I states or the more conservative corn and soybean states switching to producing products like hemp.
Yeah, actually, I wrote my column about this on DTN this week.
Perfect.
Sort of my topic, yeah. Well, the title of the column was that Jerusalem artichoke acres are expected to increase in 2019. And it was a play on, there was like this scam back in the 80s that this guy was selling Jerusalem artichoke seed to farmers across the upper Midwest, and with the promise that they would be this great source of alcohol, and alcohol would become the dominant fuel of the United States. And about half of that came true, right? Some of that came true, but... But anyway, it was a scam, and it took place during this time when people, are desperate for alternative crops, desperate for ways to diversify and get a more resilient income stream from one year to the next rather than just depending on two crops, and then one of those crops gets caught up in a trade war. It's not a great model. So mathematically, we're looking for more crops, and hemp seems great. But you're right about the dragging the feet on this. Here in South Dakota, the governor has – the legislature may act on their own, but the governor has come out saying that she wants the state to drag its feet on this a little bit and be more like a 2020 time frame.
Why?
They would have state licenses. Well, I don't know. I mean, you know me. I'm a libertarian. I don't know why there is this political backlash against it. I don't – it's hemp. It's a fiber product. And the CBD oil, nobody's getting high off of
right.
that. I don't know why politically or just maybe it's just old-fashioned people who don't realize the difference.
Right.
I don't know. What's going on in Iowa? Is there state licensing? Can people grow it even as a pilot project?
That's a great question. So my boyfriend was mentioning that one of his friends' grandfathers used to have licensing for it in Iowa back it's been quite a while if it was his grandpa and he's, mid-20s. And then another friend of his was looking into licensing. So I think people are starting to explore the option. I have another friend down in Missouri who does insurance for farmers, and he was asking me a bunch of questions not too long ago about hemp because I think – not that he listens to the podcast, but he just really didn't understand the difference between hemp and marijuana, and I think his concern was the plants look really similar, so how are you supposed to ensure that you're actually providing insurance for the hemp product and not a marijuana plant? So I think there's a lot of, I guess, in that aspect, maybe hoops to jump through. I don't really know what hemp looks like. Does it look like marijuana?
I think so, yeah. So that's one of the arguments is the legal thing, law enforcement. Like if a law enforcement officer came to a field and wasn't able
to the difference.
The person had the permit. But my impression of the marijuana growing industry, the actual THC marijuana get high growing industry in Colorado or California is that's always taking place indoors. Those are very highly
especially in like the Midwest where we have such a range of temperatures. I don't think that those plants would do well or survive. I mean, like, we're talking about delayed planting right now, or
you can grow them, but yeah,
they do well.
Yeah. So, and I've spoken to some folks in North Dakota who have had state licensed pilot program here in the past couple of years, and this gets back to this idea of any specialty crop, not just hemp, but any specialty crop. There's risk in being a first mover before the entire market is developed, because now you've got to be the one who's doing the testing and figuring out the best way to harvest this stuff,
right,
or to dry it, or to store it, or can you just use a regular baler and just store it in bales, and then where do you warehouse it because there's not the processing facilities yet. So that's one risk. But on the other hand, there's the risk for everybody else of being late to the market. Because if everybody wants to get into this and the I states, let's say, do license this or allow folks to start growing that, then everybody gets into it and the market gets flooded and the supply chain can't handle all that supply. So there's risks on both sides here.
I think it's the same when you look at the technology industry. I didn't really realize I was doing this, but I spoke mostly to ag tech companies at the Commodity Classic yesterday, and a lot of them Smart Ag, for example, which is doing the auto car to the driverless grain cart. They said it's like they've had discussions with all of the major equipment manufacturers, but it's like they're just basically waiting for one person to kind of dip their toe in the water to do, a start to finish assembly instead of adding it in after the tractor is built. They want to partner with somebody to build it initially from the start. And it sounds like it's the same story there. It's like they're all kind of just watching each other, waiting to see who's going to be the first person to buy into the idea. So I think it's the same in the tech industry as well.
Yeah, nobody wants to be MySpace. Everybody wants to be Facebook.
Did you have a MySpace, Elaine?
I didn't. No, in fact, I resisted Facebook for a very long time also. But to this point about the driverless tractors, I suspect there the risk is legal.
Right,
also,
and liabilities.
Nobody wants to be the company that makes the headlines when it runs over a child.
Exactly. Yeah, unfortunately. But interesting stuff still coming down the pipeline, that's for sure.
Absolutely. I bet it was amazing at Commodity Classic, all kinds of cool stuff.
Unfortunately, though, I missed Secretary Perdue's address. That was just this morning, Friday morning. He addressed a crowd of about 9,000 registered folks at Commodity Classic in Orlando going on right now. Of course, he talked a lot about trade, a little bit about E15. There's been, of course, that discrepancy between the USDA and what the EPA is saying as to whether or not we're going to see it hit their June 1st. But then he also spent a lot of his time talking about the USMCA agreement, what's going on right now with the Chinese-US trade negotiations. It didn't sound like, I talked to a couple of people that were down there, it didn't sound like it was anything too newsworthy or too, like, headline newsworthy. But one thing that did make the headlines earlier, just yesterday, I believe, Secretary Perdue has been spending a lot of time in committee hearings and meetings this week. And he apparently had a hard time this week in a meeting with the Senate Agriculture Committee discussing the SNAP work requirements that the USDA proposed right after President Trump signed the 2018 Farm Bill into effect. And quite a few Democratic senators said, you're going to get legal ramifications. We're going to tie this up in court for a long time if you don't change the way that work requirements work. And I think at this point in time, it's basically allowing states to get waivers from the work requirements, but he wanted to change, I think, the amount of hours people work, and then if you have children or don't have children, changing the amount they work as well.
Oh, that's interesting. Do you know, like, how much of that program is up to the states versus the federal rules?
That's a good question. I think that Secretary Perdue's proposed work rule will change that. And I think that's why it's creating so much controversy, is because then it's still in the federal government's hand, but each state will have the ability to apply for waivers, which would give them then the jurisdiction, I think, to rule all of the work requirements for their states.
Yeah, I remember, I mean, this is going way back, I think before Paul Ryan was even, whatever he was, House Majority Leader. He had that idea specifically to make any of these food assistance programs, or let's call them welfare programs, entirely state-based, so that you could have 50 different attempts at this. You could try it 50 different ways, see what works best.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. Maybe that'll be interesting. You'd learn different lessons from different ways to interpret it.
Yeah, I suppose that's true if each state had their own interpretations.
Although, yeah. So nobody would be happy, though, either.
No.
You know, probably neighbor not. Gets some get.
Yeah.
Do you know, so you mentioned the USMCA.
Mm-hmm.
You probably knew this already, but I was up at a conference in Alberta last month, and up there it's called CUSMA.
Oh, I didn't know that. How do you spell that? Like K-O-O-C?
No. So instead of USMCA, it's C-U-S-M-A. CUSMA. And in Mexico, apparently, it's MUSA. It's M-U-S-C-A.
Because they each want to list their country.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Everybody goes first. So you've got USMCA or CUSMA or MUSA. MUSCA? MUSCA. So, I don't know. Those roll off the tongue a little easier, but they are kind of
Yeah, I didn't know that one at all. Fun little fact for us for today.
There you go.
All right. Well, Elaine, let's take a look at where the commodity markets closed for today. What's your insight before I run through the prices?
Oh, I don't know. Nobody cares what the prices are on March 1st. We cared very much what they were through the month of February while the insurance prices were getting set. But now I guess we just coast until actual planting decisions need to get made.
And when will those insurance dates be released, do you think?
Oh, but you could calculate them right now. I don't know. It's like, what was the average in February?
I don't know.
I should have calculated that for you before I got on the phone today, because that would have been a good snippet of information. I'll tweet it to you, and you can tweet that out.
Okay.
Because absolutely, we can calculate that today. Is what was the average?
How do you go about doing it? You just add up every February day.
Yeah. So every time the December 2019 corn contract closed at the end of a February trading session.
Yeah.
That's one.
Okay.
Point.
So you're basically finding the mean
and find the average of those closes.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. I guess that's easy math. I could probably do that.
I'll do it for you. Okay. I'll send you a tweet.
Okay. I love it. Thanks, Elaine.
You bet.
Well, for today's grain market, it's not too super exciting. First day of March here. Final delivery was, of course, just yesterday, since we're starting a new contract month. And of course, our markets are sponsored today by the Zahner Group. Ted Seifert and Matt Zahner are at the Commodity Classic right now. If you happen to be catching up on your podcasts while you're walking around the Commodity Classic, give them a shout on Twitter at the Ted Spread, or you can give them a call anytime at 312-277-0050. Looking across the grains for today, we saw corn and soybeans earlier in the morning trading in the negative, but closed positive on the day. The March corn contract up 2 cents to end at 364 even, while the May up 2.25 cents to close at 373 even. In the soybean pits, the March contract up just a penny and three quarters at 899 1/4. The May up a penny and a quarter to close at 911 1/2. And the November out there in the future up 2 cents on the day to close at 945 3/4. The wheat markets were mixed today, with the March contract up a penny and a half to close at 454 even, while the May down 2 1/4 cents to close at 457 1/4. Looking over into the livestock pits, mixed here in the live cattle markets, with the April contract cutting 30 cents on the day to close at 129.55. The June up 27.5 cents to close at 120.42 1/2. Feeder cattle's not pretty on the screen today. Big losses both really all the way down the board. The March contract cut $1.65 1/2 to close at 141.22 1/2. The April down $1.10 to close at 145.05. In the lean hog pits, green on the screen, with the April contract up 52.5 cents to close at 56.40, and the May up 22.5 cents to close at 65.92. Rounding out our markets with the dairy class 3 milk futures, the March contract lost 2 cents to close at 15.22, the April down 8 cents to close at 15.12. For today's interview, I'm going to bring our first kind of little interview here from the Commodity Classic. I caught up with AeroVironment, who we interviewed during the Farm Progress Show this past year, to give an update on where things sit for their company. Making lots of rounds at the Commodity Classic, catching up with Brad Carraway, who's the Director of Marketing for AeroVironment. We talked to AeroVironment at the Farm Progress Show this past summer. Brad, give us the update. Where are you sitting today as a company?
Oh, we're sitting in a great shape. And I think a lot of that success that we're having is really based on the feedback that we've gotten from our customers, whether they be growers, agronomists, crop advisors, or even academic research teams. They've all really helped inform the updates that we've made to the Quantix and AVDSS ecosystem. And just to reiterate, you know, it's a fully integrated drone and data analytics ecosystem. The drone is really the tool or the data collection piece, right? And it can fly over 400 acres in 45 minutes, give you high resolution images that you can then AVDSS automatically, you know, turns into true color maps, NDVI maps, GNDVI, and then some of the new analytics that we've added are variable rate layer. So now you can export a variable rate layer as a shapefile and input that into a wide range of farm management software. And if you have John Deere Operations Center, it's even simpler than that. You can literally just click on it, and it will automatically send that variable rate layer over into the field analyzer that you've already got set up through your John Deere Operations Center. So that's just one of the new features that we've come out with, and we continue to update the whole ecosystem.
Okay, you used a lot of terms there that folks may not be familiar with. You said variable rate layers, integrating it into new systems. Pretend I don't know anything about some of the verbiage that you're using. What is it that you're essentially taking from the field with the drone and the data and giving back to growers?
So two cameras on the drone itself. We've got an 18 megapixel true color camera, so that's giving you just regular RGB still images. Then we have a 18 megapixel multispectral camera, so that's capturing near infrared spectrum. And that's really really gauging and measuring the light reflectance value off of the plants and off of the soil, which in turn gets turned into NDVI maps that show you the normalized differential vegetative index, or the vegetative health of the plant, from 0.7 and above being like really great, that plant is healthy, to 0.4 and below being like, hey, that plant is in serious distress. Those vegetative health indexes then get manipulated into different maps or layers that then give the grower the ability to zero in on problem areas. And those become anomalies rather than having to look through all these different data sets. It's just very visually easy to see, oh, yellow is bad. Okay, let me zoom in on that. Whereas green is good. What is going on with that portion of the field that's different from the other portion? When we talk about things like variable rate layer or canopy coverage or anomaly, it's really comparing those values within NDVI and giving you a starting point to make prescriptions or changes based off of that information.
So then let me ask you this. Of all of those things you just talked about, what are the new packages that might have been rolled out since the Farm Progress show?
Sure. Since Farm Progress, we've gotten feedback from customers, from a range of different customers who said, you know, I really need a package that matches up with how my operation, whether I'm a grower or an ag service provider, is structured. So we have packages that start at $5,500 and go up to $16,500. Each of them have different kind of structures to them. So for the ag services provider, $5,500 is your buy-in, you know, for the Quantix drone, and then it's $150 monthly subscription to ABDSS. That enables all the data management. We allow you to store as many acres as you want in there. There's no extra fees for it. But then it's 30 cents per acre for every acre that's processed. What that also gives you is like a host of new analytics, as well as like the ability to manage multiple different clients and have them all have their own exclusive login. For the individual grower, at $16,500, that's all in. You don't have to pay for an acre process. Process as many acres as you want, and that includes a 3-year subscription to ABDSS, the data analytics platform.
And we've got an ag service provider that uses this system, Josh Hammond, who's the owner of Pharmacist Consulting up in Dixon, North Dakota. Josh, tell me a little bit about what it was like to use this system, get it implemented into what you're doing for your consulting firm.
Well, I think what AeroVironment did was take all the best pieces of the different platforms and put them all together into one system. So it takes off vertically like a quadcopter, which is really simple and unique for me in a tight space. And I've got the longer flight capabilities of a fixed wing. So I can cover a lot of acres in a short amount of time on single batteries. And everything's complementary to each other. So everything's run from a tablet. It's all in one system. The pre-flight checks, and then just a simple swipe, and the flight is off and running. And then when I get done flying the field, I can look at it at the edge of the field. It's already on the tablet.
And you're referring to using the Quantix drone. Tell me then about the data side of it. What are you getting as far as data, and what feedback are you getting from your growers that you're working with?
Sure. So after I get home, I upload the data to the cloud. So then it goes through another process into their AVDSS, where I can look at NDVI layers, anomaly layers, plant stand counts, things like that. So I can take these images, turn it into actionable information for my growers, whether we need to fix a problem that we discovered, or we want to go push yield further. We can go make another application of fertilizer, things like that.
And in your part of North Dakota, what are you finding as far as problems or things that growers are fixing in that part of the country?
It could be something as simple as an equipment malfunction that we didn't see in the field, maybe a fertilizer skip or something like that, and we go correct it with an application like that. Could be compaction layer, and we need to go address that with something else.
Tell me a little bit about your background. Do you have an agronomy background or a precision ag background? Do you need to have that kind of a background to understand the information and data that's coming out of the AeroVironment systems?
So my background is I grew up on a farm. I wanted to be a farmer. We had a small farm and it wasn't feasible. So I've been on the research and consulting side, sales side, and now I'm on the consulting side. So a pretty diverse background, I would say. But as far as flying the Quantix, you wouldn't need any specialized background. Sometimes to interpret the different types of data, you might need a more specialized background to put it into something actionable.
Since I've got you, and North Dakota has been kind of a hot area this year as far as acreage goes, and you work directly with growers, I'm going to ask, what are your predictions this year for acreage in your part of North Dakota? Are we changing to wheat? Are they going to continue to plant soybeans? I know this year's been extremely difficult with all the trade tensions.
Yeah, I'm in the far western part of North Dakota, so we've got a wide variety of crops, very diverse, from pulse crops, oil seeds, small grains, row crops. So I don't actually even look at any soybean fields, so it's a different geography for me.
Absolutely, that's exciting. Well, Josh and Brad, thank you so much both for your time today. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you. Well, Elaine, I'm going to hold you to figuring out the insurance price. If folks don't follow you on social media but want to know what the prices you come up with, how can they follow you?
Yeah, if they don't follow me on social media, they certainly should start, I think. It's at Elaine Cub, that's E-L-A-I-N-E, and Cub is with a K. But let me tell you, a lot of years I'm really just waiting and waiting to find those prices because it's so important, and it mm-hmm. is important. But this year, I don't know, it is kind of boring. They didn't move around
right.
all through the month of February, so the average shouldn't be too surprising. The December corn price will be somewhere in the range of about $4.
And soybeans?
I don't know. What is the price of soybeans today? I try not to look at that.
Yeah.
I can't put that down the memory hole.
Like nine something?
9.45? Yeah,
9.60?
I don't know.
Not anything too great.
Yeah, but not as bad as it could have been.
Yeah. November is 9.45. Okay. So, yeah, okay. Well, maybe people won't be so excited to follow you on social media and find out that that insurance price.
Yeah, well, they'll definitely have the conversation with their insurance agent, and they might also be pleasantly surprised that the premiums might go down this year because it was less volatile during the month of February. So there is good news and, you know, kind of neutral news here involved with insurance on March 1st.
Well, there we go. That wraps up the Ag News Daily Podcast. Folks, if you want to connect with us on social media, you can find us at Ag News Daily on Twitter and on Facebook. You can connect with Elaine anytime at Elaine Cub. Feel free to shoot us your insights or suggestions for things we should be covering on the podcast. Elaine, should we let the people go?
Absolutely. Great job, Delaney.